The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Fleury.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Joel Hilliker has an excellent article posted at thetrumpet.com today about the upsurge in violence in several U.S. cities. He's following on a New York Times piece from the other day, which we'll look at in the second segment. But it's not the first to report on this. Quite a few major newspapers in the United States are now picking up on this disturbing trend. And the New York Times can't really figure out why there's this upsurge in violence. We'll look at that, as I say, in the second segment. But first, what about this mass migration of Middle Easterners and Africans just flooding into European nations? And as so many reports are saying, there's no end in sight. No one knows the solution to this problem. You'll see from one of the stories I quote from in a second, where you have nations criticizing other nations in the EU for causing the problem or for not doing enough to take on the burden of this problem. The Daily Mail says migrants and police are continuing to clash on the border between France and Italy as the Italian government refused to allow any more refugees into the country. I told you yesterday about that incident with that elderly couple that was killed by this young migrant, an 18-year-old, looking for food, looking for money. Italy can't have any more. It can't take in any more. The Mail says hundreds of people, including families and young children, are sleeping on rocks beside the sea and at packed railway stations after being banned from entering France. France is tightening its border security. Italy. The mostly African migrants have been demonstrating for 6 days now after French and Austrian officials tightened border controls due to the influx of fleeing families to Northern Europe. And quite a lot of this trafficking, by the way, it's coming through Libya, which is in a state of chaos. Chaos that was brought on largely by Western nations, led by the United States. Going back a few years when the U.S.-led coalition bombed Gaddafi out of power. And now look at Libya today. That's where so many of these boats are leaving from. As they're heading for Libya from all over Africa, hiring someone to take them across the Mediterranean, where they can get into Italy and Greece and France, Spain. Yesterday, Germany registered 3,500 refugees. That's one day's count from just one nation in the EU. And once they hit the shores of those southern states, they're trying to get up into Germany, so many of them, because to this point, the German government has been the most accommodating of all governments in the EU. And so these asylum seekers are desperately trying to get there. The Wall Street Journal, I think this was yesterday, had a piece, Chaos Erupts in Budapest as Hungary Clears Migrants from Train Station. It says Hungarian police cleared hundreds of migrants desperate to get to Germany from Budapest's main railway stations on Tuesday, prompting protests and confusion at a site that has become the latest focus of Europe's refugee crisis. It says the move capped 4 days of chaos that officials in Hungary and Austria say Germany triggered when it said last week it would ease entry requirements for Syrian refugees, sparking what the officials said was a stampede among migrants stranded in Hungary. It says migrants were demonstrating outside the train station, shouting, "Germany, Germany!" That's from yesterday. Shouting, "Germany, Germany! Save us! Help us!" The journal says some had been separated by police into a packaged passageway leading to a local subway station. By afternoon, a crowd of several hundred was outside the station with protesters in 83-degree heat holding signs reading, "Help us, Germany," or "Leave us," or "Let us leave." They chanted while beating empty plastic water bottles. An Austrian government official said that Germany's announcement last week had sparked a rush through Hungary and Austria of refugees insisting that they should be allowed to travel on to Germany. "Everyone wants to go to Germany or Sweden," the person said. "The big question remains, what will Germany do?" Yes, that's the big question. That's the question we talked about yesterday, referring to that Spiegel piece, "Dark Germany, Bright Germany, which side will prevail under the strain of refugees? Which Germany will show up? Is it the dark Germany with these hooligans and their racist chants along the roadside? Or will bright Germany show up and accept them all in?" On August 7th, there was a report at Foreign Policy about the anti-immigrant sentiment, that it's fueling arson and violence. "What's the matter with Deutschland?" the article asked. "We're seeing a bigger divide. I mean, to this point, Angela Merkel has been so popular and has had such a long run as Germany's leader. She's opening her arms to these migrants, these refugees. And so many in Germany, so much of the populace, is now saying, no, we don't want any more." That Foreign Policy piece said since the start of the year, there has been a spate of arson attacks on housing for asylum seekers across Germany as the country grapples with the swell of anti-refugee sentiment. The attacks have sparked nationwide angst and fueled a simmering debate. What are we going to do about this influx? As I said, yesterday alone, 3,500 refugees registered in Germany. Where is it leading? How will Germany respond? How will it affect Merkel's leadership? Is this bringing about or helping to bring about the prophesied strongman? Someone who will lock down Germany's borders in response to, as that article brings out, this growing concern, this growing anti-immigrant sentiment being fueled by this crisis. Back to that Wall Street Journal piece. It says, last week Berlin said it would no longer deport Syrian refugees who reached Germany via another EU country, in effect suspending EU rules that state that refugees should request asylum in the first member state they reach. And so that announcement, these other nations are now saying, is what has triggered this crisis, or this aspect of the crisis. The floodgates have now opened in Germany, and that's where the migrants are rushing to. Finally, it says, Berlin has said its decision not to turn back Syrians who have arrived from another EU country was motivated both by humanitarian concerns and as a way to speed up the review of Syrian migrants' asylum applications. As Hungarian officials blamed the chaos in Budapest on the German move, Austria, in turn, criticized Hungary's handling of the crisis. On Monday, officials in Budapest abruptly and briefly lifted a travel ban for migrants without proper visas and allowed hundreds of refugees to board trains headed for Vienna and Munich. So here they're all blaming one another for the problem, or for the lack of solutions. This problem that no one's been able to solve, and that many of these same nations have made worse by their actions in Libya, or the lack of action in Syria. What a world. Have the governments of this world solved the problems, the pressing problems of this world, or made them worse? What does it say about government? We'll get to that more in the third segment. It says a lot. So many of these nations are now picking at one another. And let me tell you, a lot of them are very angry with Britain. Because the way they see it, Britain's not carrying its share of the burden. Britain isn't opening its arms like it has with all these other migrants within the EU. It's taking in all kinds, of course, from Eastern Europe, from Southeastern Europe. But now the ones coming from Africa, coming from Syria, the Middle East, well, Britain's the farthest away, and it is separated by a body of water, and so in that way, a little more insulated from the outer reaches of this crisis of biblical proportions, as it's now being called by one commentator. We'll get to that in just a second. But here are the nations within Europe angry at Britain for not taking more of this burden on itself. This is from the Times in London. Germany has rebuked David Cameron over Britain's failure to take its fair share of migrants entering Europe, threatening to dash his plans to win back powers from Brussels. One of Berlin's leading politicians warned yesterday that the prime minister was jeopardizing relations with Germany by ignoring Angela Merkel's calls to take in more people. Mr. Cameron was told that German sympathy was drying up for Britain's out-of-the-club mentality in the face of what Mrs. Merkel described as the biggest challenge for the EU since the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's a serious crisis. Britain's not doing enough. And of course, there's the big referendum coming up as well. How will this impact Germany? Okay. How will this impact Britain's standing within the EU? There's lots of angles to this crisis of biblical proportions. The article here says losing support in Berlin would be a disaster for the prime minister after a series of setbacks yesterday in his EU referendum strategy, including a change in the wording of the referendum question, which was perceived to be biased toward the pro-EU camp. So Europe's not happy with Britain. And meanwhile, you have UKIP leader Nigel Farage warning about this flow of migrants in from North Africa, in from the Middle East, saying it's a crisis of biblical proportions. And he's explaining about how this could impact Britain. I want to play a clip for you from Mr. Farage about this mass migration problem. Notice.
The fact is, we now have the beginning of an exodus of people coming from North Africa that could even reach biblical proportions. And the European Union's response has been to put in place a common EU asylum policy. The definitions of what qualifies for asylum are so wide, we may well be talking about millions of people over the next few years. The government says it's okay, don't listen to Mr. Farage, because we're opted out of the EU asylum policy. But all the Italians have to do is to give people who come an EU passport, and then any of them can come to Britain. So there is a problem with numbers, but there's an even more serious problem, and that is that ISIS have been absolutely frank in saying that they will use this migration of people to put jihadist fighters into Europe. So there is a very big security worry as well. And frankly, it takes us back to the beginning. You know, it takes us back to what this referendum is going to be all about. Do we want as a country to control our own borders or not? And that in the end, I think, will be what decides this referendum.
That's Nigel Farage, the leader of UKIP, talking about how the mass migration into Europe poses a grave security threat to Britain. They may not get to Britain or the UK on the first pass, but once they get an EU passport, then they can move anywhere around the Union, just like those citizens in Bulgaria and Romania and Poland have done by the tens of thousands coming up to the UK. I mean, the minimum wage in Britain is 9 times higher than in Romania. It's no wonder that if you're Romanian and poor, you'd move to Britain. So many have. Well, at least to this point, with respect to those coming from outside the EU, Britain has drawn a red line. But as I say, so many in Europe are not happy about that. Well, you can see with this story, there are a lot of different angles to it. Britain eventually is going to be on the outside of the EU, looking in. Bible prophecy says so. There's going to be a strong man in Europe that does clamp down on border security, on many other issues as well. Europe itself, the Union, will downsize. Britain's not the only one that's going to be on the outside looking in. As Bible prophecy says, it's going to get down to that core Europe, that core Union of 10 kings. We'll be watching the economy. We'll be watching this immigration crisis, which, as Farage just said, could very easily swell into the millions just in the next couple of years. It's something to watch closely. Just like the immigration problem in the United States. A problem, a crisis that we'll be commenting on more in the days ahead, for sure. The New York Times today talked about the Iran deal, how it's most likely to get through. It says Obama nears needed votes on Iran nuclear deal. I guess yesterday, two Democratic senators, Bob Casey and Chris Coons, both came out and said that they would support the deal, which, as the Times brings out, brings the president very close to the numbers he needs to override a veto. The Times says Mr. Obama would veto any such resolution, and with further a resolution against the deal, that is, and with further announcements of support from the accord expected as soon as Wednesday, any move to override him would almost certainly fail. Mr. Coons' decision, in particular, is likely to have resonance with the few remaining undecided Democrats. As an outspoken member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he expressed grave concerns about the deal before deciding any alternative would be far worse. He was very concerned, gravely concerned, but then came out and said he'd support it anyway. At best, like we read to you from Melanie Phillips' piece yesterday, at best, all it does is delay the building of a bomb. That's assuming Iran doesn't cheat. But in the meantime, they are awash in cash. And they're spending it. And guess what they're spending it on? Right now, Iran is in the midst of a massive military shopping spree. Can you believe it? This from Business Insider. When negotiations on the joint plan of action began, the Iranian economy had just shrunk 5.4%. Rather than utilize that leverage to win an agreement with favorable terms, President Obama and Secretary of State Kerry sought to shower Tehran with incentives. With upwards of $100 billion in new investment now due in Tehran, Iranian authorities are starting their shopping spree with a heavy emphasis on the military. Heavy emphasis on the military. Much of it with Russia. This article talks about just the headlines that it's seen from over in that region. I think this is taken just from one day, Monday. This one from Fars News. Iran, Russia reach initial agreement on joint helicopter manufacturing. Also from Fars News, Tehran, Moscow to manufacture airplanes. This other online report, Russia to sell Iran modernized S-300 missile systems. We've talked about that previously. And then another one, Russia to coach Iranian specialists to operate new anti-2500 air defense missile systems. They're getting a lot of money, making a lot of business transactions now that sanctions have been lifted. And they're using it, first and foremost, on military hardware. Business Insider writes, given a choice between guns and butter, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei will always choose guns. And given a choice between reality and wishful thinking, alas, it says, the State Department and many in Congress seem inclined to the latter. Wishful thinking, that's the preferred route of so many in Congress and at the State Department. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. And the live stream is available anywhere you have internet access, kpcg.fm. Send us your feedback, your questions, your comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
This is Joel Hilliker, host of Trumpet Hour. On our next show, murder rates are rising sharply in cities all over the United States. This is a surprising change from a multi-year downtrend in violent crime. Why the change? We'll talk about a few reasons behind this terrible trend in America. At a recent meeting here in our hometown, Senator James Lankford from Oklahoma shared some insights into the challenges facing the U.S. today, concerns about the Iran nuclear deal, the new EPA regulations, and several other important topics. We're going to share some of his insights with you. We'll also talk about a stranger in your home that you need to be vigilant about. All this on today's Trumpet Hour.
The Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
Regarding this upsurge in violence all across the United States, in America's biggest cities, if you've noticed, a lot of major papers are reporting on it, as I said at the top. But they're talking about it in terms of just how unexpected it was. Last year, of course, they were more than happy to throw fuel on the fire of racial hatred, of the racial division. And then when it inevitably explodes in our faces, they can't figure out why there's this increase in violent crime. This New York Times piece from Monday, I believe it was, cities across the nation are seeing a startling rise in murders after years of declines. And few places have witnessed a shift in as precipitous as this city. Speaking of New York, we read another one the other day about Washington. There's all kinds of reports on Baltimore. It says here, with the summer not yet over, 104 people have been killed this year, after 86 homicides in all of 2014. So now we are at New York City. And you'll remember the two police officers there. What was it, back in December? Gunned down while sitting in their patrol car, gunned down by a thug who came from Baltimore in response to what he saw as racial prejudice. So he was out for justice. And he killed those two police officers in New York. And that's been happening all too frequently. We'll talk about that in just a second. This Times piece goes right through the list of cities. The murder rate. Startling rise, to use the New York Times' language. In New York, in Baltimore, Washington, St. Louis. Notice this quote. Law enforcement experts say disparate factors are at play in different cities. Okay, so here's the explanation for why. Though no one is claiming to know for sure why murder rates are climbing. Well, we just can't know for sure. How could this be happening? Some officials say intense national scrutiny of the use of force by police has made officers less aggressive and emboldened criminals, though many experts dispute that theory. So we just don't know. That's the New York Times. Happy to throw fuel on the racial fire in order to cause division, in order to put the blame on police or on the whites, and then it starts blowing up. And, well, we just don't know. We can't know why. Some say this, others say this. They're part of the problem. And now you have law enforcement officials all over America that have to look behind themselves when they're pumping their car full of gas for fear of someone coming along and pumping their bodies full of bullets. As that deputy down in Texas, shot from behind, execution style, once in the head and then, what, another 12, 15 rounds while he was lying in a pool of blood. Police around the United States, they're under attack, as we wrote about at thetrumpet.com.
From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
And we are back. Thanks for your patience. We had a power outage down here in the bunker. Lights went out, power went down. I guess we'll have to get a backup system in place to protect us against that happening again. Before we lost power, we were talking about the police force across cities and the United States. I mentioned briefly that one down in Texas. That's gotten a fair bit of coverage. And then here, just in the last day or two, there's been this story about Lieutenant Glenowitz, this 30-year veteran, known in local law enforcement for his work with young people, for his work with aspiring police officers. He was married. He had four sons. It says here, this is from the Chicago Tribune, Glenowitz, 52, was on routine patrol around 8 a.m. when he radioed that he was responding to suspicious activity, according to the Lake County Sheriff's Office. This is in Illinois. He started a foot pursuit, but no one heard from him after that, authorities said. And they found his murdered body later. He had discussed retiring a month ago, but was urged to stay on for a little while longer. The Tribune says he was known locally for his work with Fox Lakes Police Explorers Program, which gives youths who aspire to careers in law enforcement an up-close experience. I mentioned earlier about Joel Hilliker's article today, which he'll be talking about later on the Trumpet Hour. That's coming up at the top of the hour. You'll want to stay tuned for that. But his article posted at thetrumpet.com today, about the rising rates of violence, of murder across the United States and America's biggest cities. And this point about minorities seeking justice. What exactly do people agitating for racial justice want? He says. What sort of justice are they talking about? He asks. The View has shoved its way into the mainstream that mass uprisings in the street, including rioting, looting, and burning, are an understandable, if not legitimate expression of justifiable, even righteous anger. That, he says, is extraordinary. It's extraordinary. Still, on the more extreme fringe are voices insisting that violence is necessary to force revolution and change. Crowds are shouting, we're ready for war. Crowds are shouting. You can add to that, pigs in a blanket, fry them like bacon, go after those pigs, those policemen. They're crying out for war, and the war is here. Just ask your local law enforcement official. What would any normal human being be thinking? What would you be thinking if you were a policeman right now? Well, when you look at the problems of this world, as I said in the first segment, we have proof daily, of man's inability to solve the problems of this world. Religion hasn't solved it, as I covered with you yesterday. And certainly government hasn't solved the problems either. Herbert Armstrong, in his book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, I think I read this to you yesterday, he said, today, as in ancient times, too many of those who seek offices of power over the people of cities, states, districts, or nations promise great benefits, pose as public benefactors while their inner motives are ambitions for personal power and wealth. And then you listen to them, and they're so sure they have the solutions. They're so sure coming into office or while campaigning for office, they are absolutely certain that they have what it takes. They make all kinds of promises. As Mr. Armstrong wrote, they promise peace but bring war. They promise benefits for people and then extract from the people the cost of the benefits plus excessive costs of government. Government promises, he said, are empty. I'm going to go through some verses in Isaiah 59. Get your Bible and read along with me in these few minutes that we have left. Isaiah chapter 59. You see what Mr. Armstrong had to say about the failure of modern government. What does God have to say about man's rule in this present evil world, as Paul called it in Galatians 1? Isaiah 59 and verse 1 says, behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened, that it cannot save, neither his ear heavy, that it cannot hear. But your iniquities have separated between you and your God, and your sins have hid his face from you, that he will not hear. We've talked before about what happened in Genesis 3, the significance of God sending them forth from the garden, cutting them off from the tree of life. After Adam chose to take from the forbidden tree, he cut himself off and his family and those that would come from his family. He cut human civilization off from God. And since that time, mankind has been following a path that goes in the opposite direction of God's truth, God's laws, God's government. Notice what it leads to. Verse 4, none calls for justice, nor any pleads for truth. They trust in vanity and speak lies. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity. That's how God sees our many governments today. That's how he views government officials. Now, the Bible talks about having respect for them, those offices, for sure, Romans 13 and elsewhere. But at the same time, the Bible clearly says that this is Satan's world. It's not God's world. And so you have leaders in government saying they want justice. But look at what's happening. None calls for justice, nor any pleads for truth. They trust in vanity. They speak lies. Verse 7 says, their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity, wasting and destruction are in their paths. It's very similar to what it says in Genesis 6 about the days just before the flood. The thoughts of man being on evil continually, running to evil. Their feet run to it, it says here. And then the memory verse, verse 8, the way of peace they know not, and there's no judgment in their goings. They've made them crooked paths. Whosoever goes therein shall not know peace. There's plenty of talk about peace. There's even a lot of work that goes toward peace. World leaders strive for peace. They plead for peace. Yet there's no peace. Look at Libya, just as one example. Look at the statements that were made from the State Department, from the White House. The day those terrorists took down Gaddafi and drug his dead body through the streets. And we were told problem solved. We were told this is a victory for the Libyan people. We were told they waited long enough for the dictator to be removed. And so he was removed. And now the new Libya is rife with corruption, with human trafficking, with terrorist gangs fighting against one another. The way of peace they know not. The prophet Jeremiah said that we'll be crying peace, peace, when there is no peace. This is so easy to talk about. But look at the real world. The more we talk about it, the worse it gets. Verse 10 says, we grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night. We are in desolate places as dead men. All throughout this passage, and God does this in many other passages too, by the way, God is showing right here in His Word, His inspired Word, how utterly helpless man is to govern himself, to govern fellow man. And now 6,000 years into the human experience, here we are right on the brink. Right on the brink. A crisis of biblical proportions in Europe. At the United States southern border, in American cities, in North Africa, all across the Middle East. Is there hope in man? There is hope, don't get me wrong. But is there hope in man? Jeremiah 17 says, cursed be the man who puts his faith, his hope in other men. If that's what you do, you're going to be terribly disappointed. The ambassadors for peace will soon weep bitterly, the Bible says, when they see all the fruits of their doings spring forth. Verse 20, here's the solution. Here's the hope. Verse 20 says, and the Redeemer shall come to Zion, And unto them that turn from transgression in Jacob, says the Lord, there is hope coming. When this Redeemer comes from Zion, when God's government is established, when this world is re-educated, notice verse 21, as for me, this is my covenant with them, says the Eternal, my spirit that is upon you and my words, which I have put in my mouth, shall not depart out of your mouth. My words, which I've put in your mouth, I should say, shall not depart out of your mouth, nor out of the mouth of your seed, nor out of the mouth of your seed's seed, says the Eternal, from henceforth and forever. And then it continues right on into the next chapter, verse 1 of chapter 60. Arise, shine, for your light has come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon you. Now here is real hope. Hope for this dying world. Mr. Armstrong wrote in his book, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, the only hope of justice, of peace, of truth, of right solutions to all this world's problems is the coming in power and glory of Christ to set up world government. Right government. The government of God. The new world government. It is coming. Jesus Christ is returning to this earth, and soon. So many prophecies talk about it. And yet so many so-called Bible believers don't believe it. They don't believe it. They don't believe God will intervene on the affairs of mankind. They don't believe Jesus Christ is returning to this earth. They don't believe God is the solution. Instead, they grope for the wall like the blind. They grope as if they had no eyes, stretching and straining, looking to man for the solution, looking to human government for the solution. There is no hope in man, but there is hope. There is hope. It's a wonderful, wonderful booklet. The Wonderful World Tomorrow, what it will be like. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily radio program. This is on 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, and the live stream is at kpcg.fm. Coming up after the break, don't forget to stay tuned to the Trumpet Hour, hosted by Joel Hilliker, who also wrote today's feature at thetrumpet.com. Send us your feedback to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.